This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Okay, well, we might get started. So welcome everyone here to the National Museum of Australia, to this very special event where we're about to have the privilege of hearing the eminent archaeologist, Dr. Josephine Flood, reflect on her explorations during the 1960s, 70s and 80s into the deep patterns of human life here in the southeastern highlands of Australia. And this is the first of a series of lectures jointly organised by the Canberra Archaeological Society and the National Museum. And Lucy Blackham, who's president of the Society, is here and she'll field a few questions at the end. And I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we're meeting here tonight on Ngambri and Ngunnawal land, and that we will be talking of the high country to which many groups hold deep links, including Wolgaloo, Narigo, Yuin and Wiradjuri. I pay my respects to the elders of the past and the present who have cared for the high country and its surrounding lands and waters for so long. My name is George Main. I'm a senior curator here at the museum, where my job over the next couple of years is to lead the development of a new permanent gallery of environmental history, which is due to open in 2020. And this new gallery will feature objects and stories about the intersection of people with pathways made by other species and by natural forces. Pathways like the passage of weather systems and cyclones, the deposition of fertile desert clays across the Murray-Darling Basin by ice age dust storms, the flow of rivers, the seasonal migration routes of baleen whales and bogong moths. The museum holds a really significant collection of archaeological material associated with Josephine's work up in the high country. And we've started talking with Josephine and with traditional custodians here in the Canberra region about how some of that material, especially that which relates to the fascinating history of human engagement with the bogong moth pathway, could be displayed and interpreted in the new gallery. When I first met with Josephine, she told me that her undergraduate training at Cambridge was in the humanities, in classics, and that she'd only later developed an interest in the science of archaeology when she moved to Australia in 1963 as a 10-pound pom. At a time when Australian archaeology was just beginning to blossom. And I think that the reason that Josephine has become such a household name in Canberra and beyond is in part because of her disposition towards the humanities. She's brought an artfulness and a talent for storytelling to her archaeological inquiry. And I think it is these talents that have enabled Josephine through her writings to bestow a great value on the very long-established practices of bogong moth hunting and the lively community gatherings that moths enabled over thousands of years. So I will hand over now to Josephine. Thank you.
Well, thank you and welcome here. And I'm very happy that George Main rang me in UK and said, please come, we need you here because we're going to do a display on the moth hunters. So that's how I got here. I'll start in straight away. I'm going to start why I got involved in Australian archaeology and switched from classical stuff. The classical stuff, the problem was nobody was ever going to go to Greece or Italy. And I like field work, so I decided to switch. And this was the 60s, and very little had been done. And so I was given a huge chunk of country, the whole of southern New South Wales, basically, to be the first archaeologist to examine it. And the sort of questions we were trying to answer were, where did people come into Australia? When did they come? Which routes did they take then? And so on. Well, very briefly, of course, an awful lot of work has been going on. And we've got a lot of answers to those questions now. And we think that people came into Northern Australia, basically Arnhem Land area, between about 60 and 50,000 years, quite probably about 55,000 years. And they moved down, they went into across the Kimberley and into WA and down the coast. And they came down through the centre, went to the Willandra Lakes and Mungo. But my question was particularly what happened then. And I was looking for to try to trace early occupation down in the real southeast. And Rhys Jones had just come and he was trying to solve the problem of the Tasmanians. At that stage, people thought that Tasmanians had come on a raft from the Pacific Islands because we didn't know too much about changing sea levels. Now we've got human occupation in Tasmania because they went across the land bridge at 40-odd thousand years. So it all happened much earlier than we thought. And they moved around the continent and filled it up pretty fast, really. Well, this is the area that I took. I might say I did my PhD here at ANU, and I was very lucky to be able to do it because I had three children under the age of four. And they said, you'll never make it, but I will. And I must say a thank you to the Australian Institute of Aboriginal Studies, as it then was, because they funded they gave me a scholarship which paid for the childcare. And of course, I took the kids out on the excavations as well with uni students to look after them. And it worked. They never fell into the pit, I'm glad to say. So this is the area. And just to summarise, what we found now is there are Ice Age sites, Pleistocene sites, going back. We keep revising the dating. So in various books of mine, the dates are all too young. 25,000 years now for Burrell Lake Shelter on the coast, for Birriga, which I'll show you shortly, and for the other sites, but the ones around the mountains, people so far didn't go up into the high country, we think until about 5,000 years ago, but we're still working on that. Well, go back. There we are. This is Clogg's Cave in that cliff up there, and I was looking for old sites, and in limestone caves like this, you get very good bone preservation. So, and Alexander Gallus, who was quite elderly then, I went to see him in Melbourne. He is the man who discovered Cunalda Cave, which has wonderful rock engravings on it and everything. So I went to see him because I heard that he'd been investigating in the Buchan area, and we're on the bottom of the Snowy River here, about 2 hours' drive south of Jindabyne. And so I went to see him, and he put me onto one cave where he'd found a few stone artifacts. But I was driving along the Buchan Orbost Road here, and I've just been down revisiting this last week. And I looked across and I saw that cliff. Now, towards the right-hand end of the cliff, it looks as if there might be a cave. And indeed there is. I think you can see it towards the top right. So I walked across the fields and went in and had a look, and it was a beautiful bit of prehistoric real estate, dry, earth floor, just the sort of place you'd like to sleep for the night. So I went to see the farmer and said, please, can I come and do some work in this cave? And he said, yes, please do, because they were going to take the whole top off this hill for limestone mining. And there was a compulsory purchase order. But anyway, so he really welcomed the work. He said, just find something significant. So, and we did. Now, this is a closer view, and there's a cave that goes deep inside in the big tall cleft there, and that you just scramble across rock ledges to get there. You could do it with your hands in your pockets. Access is pretty easy. There we are. Now, the black on the ceiling of these two clefts is from smoke from endless campfires. And we excavated the outside bit, some of it, and we got under that smoke-blackened little overhang on the right. And we got to young occupation, going back a few thousand years there. And there's actually an Aboriginal rock painting there. And we weren't sure if it was Aboriginal or not. But we took a tiny little chip, gave it to the Museum of Victoria, and they found it was a very rare mineral called wedderlite, and it was mixed with animal fat, which they thought was emu fat. So it certainly is Aboriginal. But the main cave is inside the cleft to the left. And this is a plan of it. The bottom part is the rock shelter, and then you go along about a 6 meter long tunnel. But it's high enough so you can just about stand up in it. And then there's the inner cave, and the black parts are where we excavated. And in the inner cave, we did 4 square meters of excavation, so about a quarter of the available deposit. So there's lots more for the future if anyone else wants to work there. And this is the profile of the cave, and there was dim light going in, so it was a perfect camping place. And you can see on the bottom there, that's our excavation pit, which went down, to the bottom, but about 2 meters. And here am I, a younger version. This is 1971, we were there, in the pit. And we found that Aboriginal occupation going down for just about 2 meters. Oh, sorry. Okay, this is the sort of looking sideways at the deposit, and you can see the little bones poking out. The white at the top is ash from a hearth layer, and then you get the dark colour is charcoal. And there was charcoal down, which we were able to date. And these are the sort of tools we got, not an awful lot of them. This wasn't a base camp. I mean, if any of you know anything about the work that's been going on in Tasmania, wallaby hunters had base camps in the big caves like Kutikina on the Franklin River and so on in Tasmania. And there are thousands and thousands of artifacts there. They lived there all year round, and they hunted this wallaby, Bennett's wallaby, which apparently is easy to catch. Here, the food supplies were not particularly good, eels and so on, in the river, possums probably in the trees, but there wasn't anything like to really attract people to spend a lot of time there. And in 8 cubic meters of deposit, we only got 70 artifacts, which is very little. And this shows you the sort of thing we were getting, and it's basically a skin working toolkit. There's the big things at the bottom are pebble tools for chopping, maybe chopping toe holes up trees to get the possums. And then the scrapers around are for scraping the flesh off skins, either kangaroos or possums. And there were bone points there as well, which are for poking the holes through the skins, and then you use kangaroo sinews to sew them up. So it was very much a toolkit that was for people who, probably in bad weather, because it was such a good protective site, they would be there and make or repair skin rugs. And this is looking at the section, the ranging pole is in 50 centimeter sections. And at the bottom, there's a damp patch which is against the rock wall, and it's just damp coming through from the rock wall. But on the left, you can see sort of diagonal strata, and the human occupation, the artifact stops just above that. And we thought, you know, we were running out of the deposit. But what we found down at the bottom was megafauna, the giant extinct kangaroos and so on. And this, I won't go into the details because this is very complicated. We've just been, the radiocarbon dating lab here at ANU, Rachel Wood, has just been do direct dating of megafaunal bone, which she did it for her PhD at Oxford in Europe. She went around the museums there and she got Neanderthal bones out of the drawers and cupboards, and she got very successful dating of them, dating the collagen inside the bones. Unfortunately here, because I think of the conditions, there was no collagen, so we've given up on that. And I've just been down to Victoria to the next stage of the project is to do optically stimulated luminescence dating on the megafaunal stuff at the bottom. But basically, what you have here is 30,000 years of human occupation, and then with charcoal and so on. And then below that, no more artifacts, no more charcoal, but bones of the megafauna. And here is the jawbone of one of the kangaroos. He's called Sinosthenurus occidentalis, and the in situ. So, but there was dingo there. There was, thylacine and Tasmanian tiger, and a lot of the bones were chewed. And now the top two, A and B, we have there Macropus titan, and this Sthenurus, Sinosthenurus, and you can see they're bigger than a human, but they became extinct. One of the big questions at the moment in Australian archaeology is, when did the megafauna become extinct and why? And was it the same sort of date all over the continent or not? And we're still arguing about that. Well, we had a wonderful environmental record there because it was a bone bed, basically. And Jeanette Hope of this university, ANU, analysed it all for me, which was a great relief. And what we found was that at the bottom, if you look in the middle there, there's one rodent, Pseudomys yinzai, who becomes extinct, absent from the deposit at about 14,000 years, and then is replaced by another one. Well, now the bottom one is a wet sclerophyll and is now only found in Tasmania in the wet rainforest there, and he was replaced by a dry sclerophyll species. So we're getting a lot of very good environmental evidence from this cave. And this is something we didn't find in Clogg's Cave. Anyone guess what this is? Burramus parvus, the alpine pygmy possum. And it was thought to be extinct, and then they found it in a ski lodge up, up in the Alps, Mount Hotham it was. And it's not extinct. And if you're skiing up there, it might jump onto your ski stocks. And it signifies an alpine or subalpine environment. And what's really significant is it was never at Clogg's Cave, therefore that was never alpine or subalpine, because we had thousands of bones. And if it had been around, we would have found the bones. This photo was by Peter Arians, who's a local Canberra person who used to take a lot of photos up there in the skiing area. I might say we were all skiers, and one reason I did this project was that I could start my research on skis, because I had to go up and see if the moths had arrived. Right, well, we finished this work in about 1973, and put this gate onto the cave to protect it, and shored up the pit, and put a lid over the top with earth on it, a wooden lid with earth then, so that when you look through the gate, you couldn't tell that there'd been any disturbance, and we put the notice to try to say there's no passages leading off this cave, nothing to see except what you can see from this door, but they still broke in, and we had vandalism, and later on somebody removed the shoring so that, I think they maybe just wanted the planks and things, so that now the deposit is slumping at the bottom. And so the Aboriginal community down in East Gippsland, who are called Glawak, and we had a meeting last week, and we've got a new project starting to put things right in the cave, but also to do a lot more research, because of course methods have improved enormously since the 1970s. So, and it's on private land, but it is now being looked after by the Aboriginal community and the landowner who's also on site, and they're going to run cultural tourism. And they're talking about doing 3D images of the cave, so that they could tell the tourists all about it without them actually going inside, I think. Right, well, we'll quickly go up the Lower Snowy River to a cave which is called New Guinea 2. There we're actually trying to get an Aboriginal name put on it instead, because that's a silly title, but it was given by the people from La Trobe University way back, who thought the vegetation was like the wet vegetation in New Guinea. And it's on the river here. And there's a lot of cliffs, limestone cliffs, and there is the odd cave and rock shelter in the cliffs. And it is a bit of a mess. But the cave entrance is up at top left where that person is standing. But Paul Osser and his team from La Trobe, they excavated quite a lot. And I visited the excavation when it was happening, which was in the 1980s, the first half of the 1980s. And here, again, you see they didn't find much. And the trouble was that in the rock shelter, there were huge blocks of stone, which they were having to dig around and things. And so you didn't get a nice, pure, undisturbed sequence that as we had in Clogg's Cave. And they actually had to drill through some of these huge blocks to make any progress downwards. Some people have doubted it because the artifacts and the charcoal that was dated are not necessarily in exactly the same place. But the results from this were identical to those of Clogg's Cave. The tools there, the sequence of tools, again, the bones and so on. So I personally believe it because it fits in the general pattern of this area. Here's some of the bone points that they got, which of course we also got at Clogg's Cave. And then inside, there, it's a bit hard to make this out, but there's a cave, which a real cave. It has a stream running through it, and it has banks on either side. And on the walls, there are engravings which look remarkably like Cunalda Cave. They're finger markings in the soft limestone. And there was also this hearth there, an old cooking place. I don't know if it's still there because they've had vandalism trouble as well. It's very remote, this site. It's sort of in the forest going down there, and there's nobody lives within miles of it. So, but this hearth, it's a cooking hearth, and if it hasn't been excavated, it could be, and it might reveal quite a lot of information. But on the walls, this is what you have, these great panels of crisscrossing, and they're not animal claws. A lot of work's been done to distinguish human marks and animal marks. They're definitely human. Here's some more. Now, some were done with fingers, but some were done with some sort of cutting tool, probably a sharp blade or rock. Here's some more. And they've not really been properly recorded and or published. So this is a project, but that the Glauach people, because they've now got land rights to this cave, a little chunk out of the forest, and so they're working on conservation work at the moment on it, on to protect the site better. But I think they will eventually. They're training their young people in all the archaeological techniques, which is very pleasing. And as you see, these are cut marks. And they're just sort of straight lines and things. It's hard to know what they signify. But the same as Cunelda, this is one of the few which does look as if it might have been a definite design, maybe circle. As you know, in early Australian rock art, the circle predominates. So it could be something vaguely like that. And that is the way in the 1980s it was left, with an information notice and a barred gate and things, but they've had a lot of trouble apparently, so they're now trying to fix it up. Right, well, we're now coming to the ACT, and this is Birriguy, where I was taken out a couple of weeks ago, and this is the uphill side of the shelter. Now, anyone can go to the Tidbinbilla Nature Reserve and take the walking track up to the Birriguy shelter. And this was found by a teacher, and I've never found out her name. If anyone knows, please tell me. Who, Birriguy Outdoor School, the history trail used to go right through where that sort of gate thing is. And the children all came through this rock shelter. Well, she noticed there were stone tools in the earth floor. And she rang me up. I was working for the Australian Heritage Commission right here in Canberra, right through the 80s. And she rang me up and said, you should come out and investigate. And I was very reluctant because I was terribly busy. But eventually I did. And I thought, again, it was a weatherproof shelter, the best sort of place to spend the night. You could keep dry there and out of the wind and so on. So I thought it was a pretty good prospect for long occupation. This is inside. It didn't have a lot of headroom, but enough. And we were excavating in winter. And this was the Canberra Archaeological Society, who are here tonight. We did this. They provided the labour force. And it was November, December. It wasn't midwinter. It was very cold. We were able to put brushwood at one end of the shelter and keep out all the elements. And we realised that it would have been a really good place to camp out. It's not very big, as you see. And this is the excavation square. We only really did 1 metre square. The dark colour at the top is quite modern, and there were rabbit burrows up there. The Aboriginal people, apparently in the Canberra area, once the Europeans started arriving from the 1820s onwards, they moved back and used these sort of places because they were out of the way. And you get quite a lot of occupation from that period, but it went only about a metre down. Again, very few artefacts, but they were there continually, sporadically. And when we sent off the charcoal samples from the bottom, couldn't believe the dates that came back. They came back as 20,000 years. So I sent, at my own expense, another lot off to a different lab just to check it out. And they came back the same. So we had a site which goes back into the Ice Age. And as I said, now the dating is about 25,000 years, which means that it's before the last glacial maximum. But people didn't spend much time here. It certainly was never a base camp. They just came occasionally. And I had residue analysis done on the edges of the tools, and we found blood on some of them from probably cutting up carcasses, but also we found vegetable remains, so that But Berigai, I hope people have been there, but it's on the, it's just 700 meters above sea level, and so it's on the fringes of the mountains, and it's a, I think it's a transit place. Personally, I think people were coming across from Mungo, across to Lake George, through the lowest part of the whole dividing range is the Lake George Gap, and we have found very old tools at Lake George, but unfortunately no work can really go on now because the New South Wales authorities are being so restrictive, but also there's about seven land claims in on Lake George, so it's very difficult to do anything there at the moment. But actually, I feel quite upset about this because sand mining on the east side of Lake George is destroying sites, and also there's going to be housing development there. And the property on which old tools were found, and I saw them, I went out there with Rhys Jones and people in the 80s, and they, unfortunately the tools have been lost, nobody knows where they are, but they're on a property which is privately owned, and the owner is going to build houses there. So I'm afraid we're going to likely to lose all the evidence from Lake George, which could have been the Mungo of the East, but I think it's going to go, sadly. Right, well, now we're going up to Bogong Cave, and this is up above Tidbinbilla Nature Reserve. It's there's some rocks up on the skyline called Billy Billy Rocks. This is actually a bit hard to get to. Up there, you're up at about over 1,000 feet, and, sorry, 1,000 meters. The moths occasionally came down as far as this. So it was used for moth hunting sometimes. Well, this slide is too dark. I'm hoping the technical whizzes at this museum can make it lighter because all these photos are being given to the museum. And but we're inside Bogong Cave and we're actually sleeping there, if you can see sleeping bags, because it was a real pull up and all we could carry up was excavation gear. So we didn't take tents up, we just slept in the cave. But we excavated a rather small excavation in the floor, and there's moth debris, wings and things all around the floor. And we found in the bottom layer a Bogong moth pestle, which and associated with the date of 1,000 years. Yes, now here we have Dean and Travis, who are Aboriginal people who are deeply involved now in the preservation of the heritage of the ACT. This is out at Tidbinbilla Nature Reserve, and they've got the pestle Dean Freeman has in his hand, and a mortar which was found at Smoker's Gap, which was the big campsite. What happened is all the group, they camped there, and then the young men went up and collected the moths and then brought some of them down for the rest of the group. So these are now have been given to the museum, and I hope will feature in the new displays that are being prepared. But it proves that moth hunting goes back 1,000 years, and we think it probably goes back 5,000. And why? Because there was an ENSO event then which would have driven the moths from their breeding grounds because of the heat up to the mountains. But this remains to be absolutely proven. Well, this is a slide. Are the lights too bright or is it okay? In a dark room under ultraviolet light, you expose your artifacts, and if they fluoresce on the working edges, as these ones did, then it's protein and it comes from Bogong moths, which are full of protein, B because of where they were found and things. Right, well, on to moth hunting. Here's the Bogong moth, which most of you will have encountered. It's not very big, but it can be a wretched nuisance. The ABC always used to ring me up as the moth lady and say, will you advise people what to do if they've got a house full of moths? And I would say, open the windows, they're migrating, let them go, send them on their way. But they come through about the 1st of October every year, and they just fly through Canberra. Occasionally they get blown off course, land up in Sydney or something, and they're heading for the tops of the mountains. Right, well, this is Mount Gingerup, which is one of the prime moth habitats up on the top of the Brindabellas. And again, you can walk up there. You can't drive, but you can walk. And the moths used to go into all the crevices in amongst these great big rocks. And they were aestivating, which is the summer equivalent of hibernating. They're escaping the heat of the breeding grounds, which are in southern Queensland and western New South Wales. And this happens every year, but though the quantities vary a bit. And this is what they do. They sit on the walls like this, and they only become active at dusk. And George Main was telling me that he camped up on Mount Gingerup, and at dusk there's this amazing sound of the sort of, how would you describe it, a sort of a weird buzzing noise almost out in the sky, and they're just having a fly around, and then they come back and sit back on the wall. Somebody actually counted them once, Ian Common, who was an entomologist at CSIRO, and he got 17,000 on one square metre of wall, so there's a lot of them up there. And how the Aborigines caught them, it's quite easy. Because you take up a piece of bark or a net, and you just run your hand or whatever along the bottom row, and they all fall down. And I'm very glad to say that this museum is taking the initiative of getting somebody to recreate these nets. They have to be very, very fine mesh. They're made of pimelia or currajong. We have some historic accounts from Europeans as to the making of them. So hopefully by the end of this year, there'll be some nets in this museum. But bark containers do. And in a vintage year, this is what they do. They take every little bit of rock wall and they sit there. And that's how they start at the highest peaks, but in a vintage year, they'll come down a little bit. And I don't really understand why the quantity varies, but it could be activities like pesticides or something out in the breeding grounds, or it could be that sometimes they get blown off course so that only small numbers arrive. Well, we did experimental archaeology, and this is us in the 80s, up on the top of Gingerup, and I'll give you the recipe. What you do, big granite slab, you build a fire on it, but then once the fire has been going well, you scrape it away so there's only a little bit left, and then you pour the moths on, and you give them about a minute on each side, stir them around with a stick, and then when you think they're done, you winnow them in the sense that you try to get rid of quite a lot of the ash. And then you either eat them straight away on a stick or whatever, or you make them into cakes. And the Aboriginal people used to make them into cakes and carry them down below to the larger group. Women and children and old people would be down in the valley. And we have historical accounts about this. The 500 recorded in the Gudjimby area, near the Gudjimby homestead. Blowering Tumut, big gatherings there. Jindabyne, big gatherings. So that, and lots of festivities and ceremonies and so on went on at the same time. Well, this is my son, Adrian, a bit younger then, sampling a moth. He wasn't too sure about all this. But there's Daryl Lewis, who some of you know. He was very active on field work with us during the 70s and 80s. He was on the Clugg's Cave excavation. He's now done a PhD, and he's up at the University of New England. And there's me. I didn't mind moths. I used to give moth and wine parties. When we launched the Moth Hunter's book in 1980, it was a moth and wine party. And I always used to keep some in the freezer in case anybody wanted to sample them. We put some in a thermos flask and got it to Sydney University Human Nutrition Unit, and they analysed them, and they found that they're incredibly rich in protein. So the Aboriginal people, the moths are there up on the tops for about 5 months. So the accounts of the Aboriginal people coming up pretty emaciated after a winter living on possums, and eels perhaps from the Snowy River, and then coming back sleek and fat after feasting on the moths. Well, associated with the moth gathering were ceremonies, and here we're on Century Box Hill, which is in the far south of the ACT, and there's a stone arrangement there. But you also look, that peak in the middle with lots of rocks showing is actually Namadji, and there's a wonderful stone arrangement up there. And these stone arrangements were put there to do with ceremonies, particularly initiation ceremonies, so the young men were taken up. And here, a bit hard to see, but it's a single line of stones which goes right across these big slabs. This is the Namadji stone arrangement. You have to take yourself up there. It's quite a pull, but it's worth it, so I would recommend it. You go from Creamy Flats. And this is a sort of corridor arrangement up there. And we have some European accounts of what happened, and apparently after the initiation ceremonies, you get wonderful views from there. So the elders would point out the tribal territory, and they would say, you know, those people are over there, their friends, that lot there are enemies, and so on, and go around. So it was quite a long drawn out affair and complex. Well, my first helicopter ride ever was to take these signs and bags of cement and things up to Namadji to put them around the rock, the stone arrangement. And the reason being that people that sometimes move the stones and mess things up. And also there is an old pastime called boulder trundling, which some climbers go in for, and you get up there and you see who could trundle down the slope, the biggest rock. So we wanted to avoid that happening, so we put up these signs, three of them, so whichever direction you found this stone arrangement, you'd know what it was. But it went wrong because the helicopter crashed on the top. And I'd never been in a helicopter before, and it dropped like a stone and sort of landed on its side. And luckily, it wasn't really onto rock. There was a lot of heather there as well. And I said, that was a bit of a rough landing, wasn't it? And the pilot said, we've crashed. And I don't understand how helicopters work, but I think one of the wires that goes from the front to the back had broken. But the radio was also broken. But we were very good. We put up our signs, got them all set, and then we had to walk out to the upper cotter because the helicopter couldn't be resuscitated at all. And the pilot was wearing thongs on his feet. Oh. But we got there just as it was getting dark. There's no track, and I wouldn't recommend it. It's very rocky sort of scramble down. And of course, our families back here in Canberra were going absolutely frantic, but it was all okay. But I've never been in a helicopter since. Right, well, we'll bring you on to local sites. Yankee hat here. Now, this is also open to the public. You go to Nemadji Visitor Centre and you walk across on a well-marked walking track from there, and you can see it's at this, the rock art sites are at the bottom of that hill, just on the tree line. And this was it way back in the 70s. The Boots family from Gudjimby had put fencing round to stop the cattle getting in there and rubbing the paintings away. So it was being protected. And we did an excavation because it was one of the very few sites, Aboriginal sites, that were known. I might say, when I started, some people said there weren't any Aboriginal sites in the ACT. Others said, well, there are these rock painting sites down at Gudjimby. And so I wrote a letter to the Canberra Times and said, anybody know any sites? And I got a very good response, particularly from the shooters who go around the hills and notice stone tools lying on the ground. So eventually we got 200 campsites in the open-air campsites in the ACT and quite a few excavated rock shelters. And this is the Yankee Hat one with the paintings. Of course, they've got badly affected by that bushfire, I hear. And has anybody been out there in recent times? And has a boardwalk been put back in? Is somebody nodding there? Anyone know? Please speak. Yes? Thank you. Okay. But did the fire really affect the paintings? Because this is a very old photo from the 60s, say. It did affect them a bit. Oh, good. Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that. And this is Rendezvous Creek, which you can also go and visit. It's a bit more remote, beyond Yankee Hat. And there are lovely paintings of birds there. The plains turkey with its head up in the air. These have been recorded in detail. And the sort of tools we got there were these small tools, and these sites tend to go back about 4,000 years, but there's a lass who may be here tonight called Fenya Thaden Ringle, who's just finished a PhD on the High Country. And she has found, well, the oldest site in the High Country is 5,000 years, I think I'm right, and it's up at Nursery Swamp, which is higher. And I think it could be associated with moth hunting in that the people may have been going up there on their way to the high mountains, because I can't think why else you'd go to Nursery Swamp. And this Tidbinbilla hanging rock shelter on the right there, which we also excavated. But there was a pattern that the high-level sites like these were not older than 5,000 years. Well, now I'm bringing you to the Molonglo River near Pialigo. And I have had the great experience since I've been in Canberra this time of seeing in the museum stores out in Mitchell artifacts that were collected way back from the shores of the Molonglo River and the Murrumbidgee before the lake came into being. And they are quite distinctive. And I think the ANU students should be, or maybe the Archaeological Society should be roped in to start studying these collections because they're magnificent. You've got Ice Age artifacts, and they're very easy to access in the Mitchell repository because they're all labeled and digitized and things as regards the inventory. And they're in pull-out drawers. So I was just astonished to see these wonderful old artifacts that are just sitting in a museum drawer and have never been studied. And the first Canberra Archaeological Society expedition I ever went on was in 1964, led by Jack Goldson. And it was to Pialigo. And this is the rubbish dump at Pialigo. Well, unfortunately, in those days, you didn't save sites. You just did a bit of rescue archaeology. And so It's by the airport, and it was all destroyed, but useful people, some of them from the Canberra Archaeological Society, like Peter Bindon, collected things there, and they are also all in the museum. Although they're not on display, but they're available for study by students or others, so the information hasn't been lost. And I think it was in the 80s we started working with Aboriginal people here, and this is Matilda House in the 80s out at the Yankee Hat site. She and I went out there, and we realised how much information they had and were able to help us in lots of different ways. And this is her son, Arnold, and we were recording the scarred trees on the right there, but the one on the left, lots of you will know because it's the Lanyon canoe tree, and it's just north of Lanyon, and again, anyone can go and visit it, and it's beautiful. So another project I'd like to suggest, I might say I'm not going to do these things, but I'm hoping other people may, is to record all the scarred trees around Canberra. This one on the right is down in Tuggeranong, because of course they're vulnerable. Bushfires come, or cars crash into them, or something happens. So the Canberra Archaeological Society needs to get going and do a few of these things. I can say that because it'll be others who do it. But there's really a lot of scope. And also, we do get vandalism. We've lost one of the axe grinding groove sites in Canberra through vandalism, and they're very rare. Luckily, we took a full suite of photos, so we at least we know what it was like, but it's been messed. And this is my last slide, which Dean Freeman and me talking within the Birriguy Rock Shelter about the future, and I feel really good about it because the Aboriginal people now out at Tidbinbilla and elsewhere are really keen and interested, and they're collecting materials and they're doing research, and you know, it's become a joint effort, whereas in the early days it was archaeologists, but now it's very much a joint effort, so that I'm optimistic about the future. Okay, that's it. Oops. No, going the wrong way, sorry. There we are. Shall I turn the lights on?
Thank you for that, Jo. Just to finish up, we're going to have some questions from the audience, if anybody would like to start. Just down the front here, sorry.
I just wanted to ask a question about what you started the talk off with. I've had this understanding for a long time that Aboriginal people were here in Australia much longer than 50,000 years, and you said in one of your early slides that they come from somewhere, they weren't here. Why is it that they've come from somewhere?
There's been a lot of work done now on DNA, and we can trace the passage of Homo sapiens, us people, from North Africa, leaving there at about 70,000-80,000 years ago, coming across Arabia Gulf, down through India, right the way across. And this has been traced both from archaeological sites, but also the Aboriginal DNA is, you can trace all the way coming across. So it definitely did happen. One of the things we're still debating is how they actually got to Australia, and we think they came by boat. And they came across from the islands like Timor and the ones between Indonesia and here because of the volcanic activity. If you've got a volcano erupting and you're losing your homeland, you jump onto a log or a boat, and people have built bamboo rafts to see, with stone tools, to see how long it takes, about 10 days from Timor, and to land in Australia. So there's been so much work done in recent years that I think it's quite definite now that Aboriginal people haven't been here forever. They came and they made a go of it, survived in what is a very tough continent. You know, we don't have the grains you could turn into agriculture and things in Australia. And they remained semi-nomadic in that they tend to move around, exploiting different food resources in different places. I could recommend one of my books, which has an diagram of this DNA progress. I think that was my last book, which was The Original Australians. So let me recommend that.
Made the hills and the valleys.
Yes.
And the ancestors, the ancestors being part of the land, how does archaeology match with the spirituality of Australian Aboriginal people?
Well, in fact, what we have discovered is that the oral traditions go way back. As you know, there was a sea level rise at about, between 14,000 years ago and 6,000 years ago when the sea reached its present level. And it had been way down, about 130 metres below what it is now. And there are stories about the rising of the seas and getting cut off, Kangaroo Island getting cut off, and also volcanic eruptions. Now, you can date volcanic eruptions exactly. We have stories, oral traditions of the Aboriginal people, which relate to a volcanic eruption 10,000 years ago. This is in the Atherton Tablelands, but also down in Western Victoria. So there's lots of good evidence that the oral traditions do reflect real events.
Joe, I have a question up the back here.
Thank you very much indeed for a most fascinating talk. Yankee Hat seems to stand out in the rock shelters that you've shown us tonight in the fact that it has quite a number of paintings, many of which are also overpainted. Why do you think that is?
It's a very good rock shelter. You know, you get good shelter from a good sloping roof, and I think it was well placed. There's water not too far away, and you're in a good strategic position looking out over the valley. So, you know, if you're classifying real estate in the ACT, you would put it probably at the top. It also has a smooth black back wall, which a lot of them don't.
Wish you'd worked when you were here on the lovely Ginninderra Gorge. The elders tell us that was the Ginninderra Gorge, and just to the northwest, just across the border, it was a very important ceremonial ground. Only belatedly are reports coming out how important that was. So it's all set for a joint operation and a lot of work to be done. Do you know anything about it?
No, I don't. It was probably after my time, in the sense that in 27 years, I've been working on rock art in the Northern Territory and not doing anything local around here at all. I wanted to work with Aboriginal people, and also they love us researchers to go up there. But we have to do the research in school holidays so they can bring the children out, teach them all about, hand on the culture, but teach them about bush foods and all that sort of thing. So I've been out of it for a long time. A lot of work has been done by consultants, and sadly, most of that is not published, so we don't know what they found. I again hope that maybe the society, the Canberra Archaeological Society, can do something about this, because they can provide a workforce, but also they can keep an eye and make sure that the right thing is happening as to where the artifacts that are found actually end up and all the rest of it. I mean, we have the ACT Heritage Authorities, but I don't quite know. Well, all their stuff is stored in Lynham and it's not accessible. Sure. Well, please, the president of the Canberra Archaeological Society is here tonight. Will she please stand up? Okay, there's a task for you. Follow these things up.
Yeah, it'd be great if you emailed us to let us know. So that's okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Flood. I found a lot of what you said very affirming. Those line pattern rocks seem to denote tribal areas and clan groups,
mm-hmm.
but near a lot of the axe groove sites, I've found quite a few mapping sites that then lead you on to other ceremonial grounds.
Yes.
It's a shame that you mentioned Lake George and the development there, because with the men's site there, there's like a moon tree, and then there's some of the rootstock at the base of the tree mm-hmm. denotes some of the women's business and the women's side on the other side. It's disappointing for me that there are so many interconnected sites. We've got quite a big creek system here in the ACT, so mm-hmm. when you come from the Axe Groove site in South Canberra, it goes to the Tuggeranong Arts Centre, you've got the Ginninderra Creek that goes to Belconnen Arts Centre, you've got the Canberra Glassworks on... you've got the theatres and the arts complex along mm. Sullivan's Creek, but it seems as though a lot of the cultural history has been reframed by a lot of these arts institutions, and I find that very disappointing, because none of the Aboriginal heritage reports refer to the interconnected sites, and they don't refer to any of the song lines. So when you talk about the Bogon moth, what I've found is between ceremonial grounds, you'll find pathways of moss or wallaroo or other species mm-hmm. like the legless lizard. And there are in those reports that go into Aboriginal heritage, they don't actually discuss the relationship between the people, their customs, the traditions and ceremonies that mm-hmm. helped facilitate that biodiversity and that symbiotic relationship. So mm-hmm. I think it's very disconcerting that we are actually destroying a lot of these cultural pathways, we're destroying mm-hmm. a lot of these migratory routes, and we're reframing the context. So I'll give you an example. You mentioned the trees.
Yes.
I find it disconcerting, I think is the word, where you mentioned the canoe tree.
Yes.
The long slivers in the trees, if you follow mm-hmm. those, they'll lead you to the planting grounds.
Mm-hmm.
The round sort of shield-like trees, if you find two patches together with like a reference marker on the other side that's about the size of your mm-hmm. hand, it refers to like a sacred site. So the different patternings of those scar mm. trees denote different ceremonial and customs. So I find it disconcerting when the value of those trees are diminished to mere craft product. When the older men teach younger men mm-hmm. how to do the markings, or when they're doing the grooves, or when they're placing the rocks, they're describing the whole lineage of customs to the young mm. men. So when you just say this denotes that clan group or this denotes mm. that, it actually, I find it a degradation on the ceremonial practice.
It's certainly not meant that way, but the problem is we don't know, you see, because this sort of thing that you've said today, I have never heard anyone say that before. I've never seen it written down. So people like me, we don't know. But I hope that you're passing on this sort of knowledge to the people who are influential. And I was delighted when I was out at Tidbinbilla to find that there's a book done by the local Aboriginal people on the local plant foods. Now, that is a step forward, but if you could put that sort of knowledge, so that other people know, so that maybe next time you're standing up here telling us this sort of thing, because we don't know. If it's not in the historical records, and nobody has ever done a report or written a book or something, then there's no way we know all this detail. So your knowledge is wonderful, but please pass it on in some way or other.
I'm a descendant of the Snowy people from the
people?
High country.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And I sit at home watching TV of the digs that go on in your country.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to thank you for coming to our country and digging up our past. It's been a thrilling evening for me.
Well, it's been a great pleasure for me. I have two passports, and I have three children who live here and five grandchildren, so I go to and fro. I feel I've got a foot in both countries.
I'd also just like to say thank you for the talk today, but thank you also for some of the work that you've done in the past. I know you've done some work at Umbergong District Park and were instrumental in helping that place be renamed as Umbergong in terms of in recognition of the axe grinding grooves and the significance of Aboriginal people there. And part of that work has led to the development of an Aboriginal land care group that's now working to protect and restore cultural sites in the Jindera catchment.
So excellent. Okay.
And and there's also an Aboriginal Green Army team that's just started that's being supported by the catchment group. So thank you.
Very good.
Yes, I'd like to... Is that on? I'd like to say that, as my mother just said, that what you have documented and recorded for us gives us a very good basis to continue research. I would also like to say, building on what was just said before about this sort of holistic understanding of our environment, in a sense, we as Aboriginal people are just starting to sort of offer ourselves up as well as part of the archaeological record in a very living, modern way. And so for people of my mother's generation and others, of course, it was very difficult to share anything or even have anything passed on because there were so many pressures to not do that because you could, well, you could be locked away in an institution for being somebody who is too visibly Aboriginal. So. And I would like to see the Australian government put its Arts, Languages and Culture program, which is now growing, thank goodness, I've managed it myself in the past, it into an actual holistic kind of way of recovering knowledge, culture, language, which is my particular interest. The Ngunnawal mob and Ngambri here in Canberra working very hard, and we now have our Prime Minister actually opening his, for example, Closing the Gap report using the language of this area. So the first time ever in our history in Australia a Prime Minister has actually opened something using a language of the country on which he's privileged to be working. And, you know, the Institute for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies now has got recognition for its amazing records and more funding to keep those records properly archived and do things with them.
Yes.
And the National Museum is, of course, a natural partner here and all the universities and all the state libraries and collections. So I think, you know, building from the wonderful work that you and others as pioneers in, you know, let's say in the white establishment academic world have done, your legacy for us, now there are more Aboriginal people also coming through the academic establishment, I'm part of that, that we do club together, work with the Canberra Archaeological Group and other historical society groups and communities that, as you're saying, are now bringing on their own archaeologists. I mean, this is a great step forward. We will have a cohort of people from community who have the technical knowledge and expertise also to contribute.
Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful moment in Australian history where we can really build on all of this.
Well, thank you very much. I absolutely agree with you, and that's why I'm feeling good about the situation here, but also in Victoria and in the Northern Territory. But one thing I didn't mention at all is any of us who investigate Aboriginal culture or find things, we have an obligation to conserve it and to put our records and our photos and everything else into the right places. Now, all my colour photos back from the 1960s are in the Institute of Aboriginal Studies, which keep them under perfect conservation conditions, which is what you need, because we have rock art sites that collapse and the only thing we have left are photos. But also, artifacts need to go to the correct place in whichever state you find them in or are working in. And I have put, I did this for the Canberra Centenary, I've put all my written records into the Heritage Library in Woden. And I've given open access to anybody. And also, anybody can use any of my photos. I've decided at my age, I turned 80 last year. It was a sobering moment. I thought so much to do still, and maybe not an infinite amount of time. So I'm getting on with it. And so that all my stuff is accessible somewhere or other. And of course, I'm hoping that next year this museum will have a beautiful display that covers moth hunting and everything else. Thanks.
Thank you for that, Jo. It was another fascinating talk, and it's lovely having you back in camera. We just had a small gift for you tonight. Oh,
thank you very much.
Coming along.
Sort of gift I like. Thank you very much.
Sorry, thank you for coming. It was okay. A pleasure. Just to finish up tonight, I just thought I'd make you aware of our next lecture, which will be with Wally Bell. He'll be doing an Aboriginal perspective of archaeology, so hopefully we have some more interest in that one. It'll be lovely to see you all there. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.